Good journalism, to paraphrase the late playwright Arthur Miller, is, he said, I suppose, a nation talking to itself. And today, as our conference unfolds, that statement is going to be demonstrated as journalists and academics and the public at large, you, come together to examine what many believe is a defining moment in American journalism. Few issues are as important today to our democracy than a free and independent press. And the quality of the news report, by be it daily or weekly, is really critical to the decision-making process of the public and the officials who serve at its pleasure. So if and when the pressures on the bottom line impinge on the quality of that report, journalists and the public alike need to address the consequences. And at the same time, it must be remembered that what we are talking about is the, quote, news business, unquote. And the very name implies the necessity to turn enough of a profit to keep the enterprise moving ahead. You know, there's an old riddle in the news business that journalists have contemplated for decades, and that is, do you publish a newspaper to make money, or do you make money to publish a newspaper? And, you know, there may be no right answer to that question, just as we may not produce any definitive answers to the questions posed during our conference. But the very fact that so many people representing so many constituents are here and asking the questions indicates how important the issue is that we're discussing. So the College of Communications is proud to be a co-host of this conference along with the Illinois Initiative for Media Policy Research. What I'd like to do now is, before I introduce our panelists, I would like to ask our panelists to keep, they'll keep their remarks to within 10 to maybe 10 minutes or so. And once all of our panelists have had a chance to talk, I will open the session up to questions from the floor, and there are microphones on both aisles. So please don't be shy and come up and ask as many questions as we can get in before 10:30. So let me start by introducing our panelists very quickly. To my immediate left, we have Orwell Schell, who is the Dean of the Graduate School of Journalism at the University of California, Berkeley, and a frequent correspondent for Frontline, a PBS program. And to his left is Linda Foley, who is the president of the Newspaper Guild. She's also vice president of the International Federation of Journalists, representing some 500,000 journalists in more than 100 countries worldwide. And she's secretary treasurer of the, I can't read my own writing.
The Department for Professional Employees.
Department for Professional Employees at the AFL-CIO. Okay. That's a real problem when you're a reporter and you can't read your own notes. Okay, and next to Linda, we have Danny Goldberg, who is the CEO of Air America Radio, a liberal talk radio network, and a former chairman and CEO of Artemis Records. And to his left is Cy Hirsch, Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter for the New Yorker magazine, who broke the story in 2004 of torture at the Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq. And from my generation, I know Cy more for his work and his coverage of Vietnam and uncovering the My Lai massacre in Vietnam back in the 60s. So there's no real order here. What I'll probably do, make it just easy, we'll just start to my left and we'll start with Orville and we'll just proceed down the line. How's that? Okay?
Well, thanks. It's nice to be here. This is a kind of an unusual panel because it's, much to my great surprise and delight, it has no topic, which allows all of us to, I think, give you our most prescient thoughts. I guess the subtopic of why we're all here is what's wrong? And I think everybody has a inchoate feeling that gets expressed in many different ways that there is something increasingly perturbed and wrong about the connection of America's media to the process of watchdogging corporations, the church, government, academic institutions, whatever. And that there's some breaks in that very critical food chain of information. You know, it's interesting, within my lifetime, and I think I'm very much a product of this presumption, and I wager everybody on this panel would share this sentiment, that there's a presumption that if you can do the research, this is the fundamental sort of building block presumption of knowledge itself. If you can do the research, you can make the revelation, you can inject it into the public, certain things will happen. You will have outrage, you will have people upset, you will have hearings, you will have court cases, you will have legislation, you will have citizens groups putting their shoulder to the wheel, you will have corrective action taken. I think we've entered a period where that presumption is a presumption that is not foregone. There is something about the process which is so fundamental to the whole notion of how our system of governance works that is now, I think, in doubt. And this means that journalists who exist at a very important end of that food chain now are in a position where it's almost as if we don't matter. We can do our part, but if the rest of the chain of cause and effect is broken, it doesn't really matter. Now, closely allied to this dilemma, in my view, is another equally insidious force that's aloft in the land, and that is the difference between revealed wisdom and knowledge and empirically derived wisdom and knowledge. Again, the whole reason why you all are at a university, why we all are journalists, is that we believe that it takes hard work to understand what reality and truth is. But this other kind of revealed wisdom comes down from on high. It doesn't come up from the bottom. It doesn't need to be proved. And it is a terribly, I think, destructive sort of antidote to sort of the empirical basis that journalists sort of really hold most dear, I think, as the principle of principles. And it manifests itself, of course, most obviously in the kind of policy that is a policy in search of evidence and justification rather than evidence that leads to policy. And if we as journalists are cut out of that process, namely the evidentiary process that then leads to consideration and policy, well, then we are marginalized. So I think it almost seems sometimes as if we have been bulldozed off to the side. It's not that we can't do our work, it's harder to do our work, but it's that, in effect, what is said to us is, we don't believe you, we don't trust you, you don't really have a role in the process of policy formation and governance. You're basically bashers, naysayers, negative, you know, nattering nabobs of negativism, as Spiro Agnew once said. And you can go off to your little sandbox on the side of the playground, and you can play, but we don't read newspapers. We don't read magazines. We don't even watch television except our chosen channels. So it doesn't really matter what you do, but have a good time doing it. That's very frightening. And it also obviates, I think, the whole presumption, as I said at the outset, of what the role of journalism, and indeed, it isn't too big a leap to get to the role of education from that. What's the point of learning if empiricism finally is not the rule of the game? Now, it seems to me, you know, I'm sure all of you, like me, have libraries just filled with books. You've read some of them, you haven't read some of them. They're all saying, what's wrong? You know, folks, I want to tell you, the work has been done. We know what's wrong. The question is, what can be done about it? And I think that probably is something that we should talk a little more about, because I think at the heart of the matter lies a wager which we are very ill-equipped to meet, and that is the fundamental contradiction between the ways in which media outlets are held in a financial sense and what they can do. And I think unless we examine the different ways that media are held so that they are, to one degree or another, bottom-line driven, they're not bottom-line driven, they can do this, they can do that, I think all of these books that sit there, you know, dumbly in my library will have not a hell of a lot of an effect on anything. And all of you in your mass communications departments all over the country can research till the cows come home. It's not really going to help. Because until we find a way to hold media that can provide a refuge to serious reporters who know how to do the work, want to do the work, to offer them a safe harbor, I think all of our criticism is somehow irrelevant. Now, let me give you a few examples. I had a very interesting occasion a week or two ago. There was a big gathering in San Francisco called Input, which was all the public broadcasters from all over the world. We had a kind of a hearing with a group of them, someone from the CBC in Canada, Kenyan Broadcasting, Japanese Television. Who else was on that group? One or two others. And the question was this, mostly in relation to broadcast: what's the best way to hold a broadcast entity so that it can do what we all know it needs to do? Is the state ownership the best way? Is private ownership the best way? As you know, when a broadcast entity is held privately, the expectation of Wall Street is 40 to 50% return on invested capital per year. It's a huge amount of rake-off of profit. In newspapers, it's 20 to 25, 20 to 30% expected return on capital, except in those papers where the voting stock, such as the New York Times and the Washington Post, are controlled by the families. And if they have sort of good ethical groundings and intentions, maybe they can afford to have their profit margins some years be lower. That's a huge dilemma. I had occasion, just talking to Cy about this, to talk to the editor of The Guardian in London. Very interesting. That paper, it's a wonderful paper. And do you know how it operates? It has a trust behind it. It was set up by somebody who put a commercial trust in the service of the paper. And it kicks in tens of millions of dollars every year into the running of the paper. It's an interesting mix of sort of public and private, of foundation-supported public interest journalism matched with advertising and, you know, circulation-driven, all of the things that a paper must contend with. Very interesting model. Long talk with this guy, Albert Scardino. His wife actually runs the FT and the Pearson Group. Very intelligent guy. And I thought, this is interesting. This is the sort of thing we need to be talking about. The BBC, interesting model. It is a trust. License fees get paid into the trust. And it is not run by the government. It is mandated by the government. It is governed by a board of governors that has to have approval every 10 years from the parliament. They just went through this to some consternation. In Europe, there are many state-owned broadcast entities. There are a few papers in our own country, in St. Petersburg, for instance, which are also trusts. I think this is the nut of the problem. Is there a better way to hold some portion of the American news establishment, whether broadcast, print, or magazines? Places like Harper's, Mother Jones, The Nation, and there are others, are also trusts. They're also nonprofit organizations. But these business models, which we haven't invented yet, cannot simply be begging every year to the Ford Foundation. There's got to be some longer-term sustaining mechanism which will allow a different kind of journalism, which will dignify journalists with the opportunity of doing the sort of work they want to do. We have all had experience of having good stories, good ideas, and we can't find a place to put it. People blame journalists, and we have many faults. In actuality, in my experience, the real problem is not that there are not enough good journalists who want to do good work, but there are not enough places for us to go to do that work. And so that you all then are deprived of our best efforts because we spend most of our time straggling around from this place to that place. I had a really interesting experience with a news magazine. They commissioned me to write an article. Paid me pretty well. And by the time the article was published, it had been reduced to, I think it was 150 words. And I thought, well, what the hell? I mean, this happens all the time, this sort of thing. And it wasn't that the article wasn't good. It was, you know, they didn't have enough room and this, that, and the other. And they're all very sheepish and apologetic. You know, the end result of all of this is nobody feels very good. The editors feel debased. They feel humiliated. They're treating writers badly. The writers feel badly. Nobody feels good except one group, and that's Wall Street. And they set the agenda. And thus, we look debased. We end up not being respected. The press ends up being criticized. And we have no real way to fight back because we simply do not have the financial mechanism to shelter us, to help us do our job in a way that is more dignified and in a way which I think would bring esteem to the press. It's a real problem. So let me just conclude by saying, for me, again and again and again, when I sit on these panels, when I read all these books, when I think about what's wrong, it gets back to the fundamental question that we do not yet have good business models, but the right mix of public and private interest to sustain, to protect, and encourage the kind of journalism which I think our founding fathers imagined when they set up this country, and which I think is absolutely plain on the face of it, necessary for this country to function properly. And I think we are on the precipice of having an insufficient supply and an increasingly less informed public upon which the country still depends to make decisions. And I think it's reflected in our government.
Thank you very much. So move on to our next panelist, Linda.
Thank you. Orville sort of was a very good discussion prior to what I want to talk about today, which is the effect of consolidation both on journalism and on journalists, particularly journalists in the mainstream media themselves as individuals. But before I do that, last night we heard from Congressman Sanders and Amy Goodman and Naomi Klein about stories that are not being covered. And I also want to mention, and I would be remiss if I didn't mention, that there is a huge story in this country that isn't being covered, among other huge stories that aren't being covered. And that's the dissolution and dismantling of the free trade union movement in this country. You never see this in the press. You do see inner scene squabbles between unions covered occasionally, but you don't see the fact that actually the ability to organize and belong to a free trade union in this country is imperiled and is just about on the verge of being wiped out. And I would just say to you that along with a free press, freedom of association is also part of the First Amendment, and there never has been a democracy in the history of the world that has not had a free trade union movement attached to it. So I just put that on your radar as well. In terms of consolidation of the media and corporatization of the media, I think that in terms of journalism and its effect on journalism, we need to understand what journalism is and how corporatization and consolidation of the ownership of the media affects that. And there's a quote that I really like that describes journalism that I operate from this presumption, and that is, this was said by Lord Norcliffe, and he said, "Journalism is a profession whose business is to explain to others what it personally does not understand." And in a complex world, the complex world that we live in, that's a very, very important role that journalism plays. Journalists themselves need to be connected to their communities. They need to be connected to the people that they are serving. And what is happening because of the increasing absentee nature of the ownership of media outlets, particularly local media outlets, there is a wall being erected between the journalists in the newsroom and everyone else, except a very small class of people who hold Wall Street values, as has been said. Why is consolidation happening? Well, if you look at consolidation of ownership and you look at consolidation of the media, for one reason. The media is being consolidated to gain efficiencies, and that means more profits, and that's really the reason that it's happening. It's pretty simple. What that has meant for the journalists in the newsrooms is, right off the top, it has meant job cuts. There are fewer newsroom jobs, 1,200 fewer newsroom jobs, to be exact, than there were a decade ago in the industry I'm most familiar with, which is the newspaper industry. But total employment in the newspaper industry has increased during that same period. At the same time, actually, the number of people who consider themselves journalists or who would like to consider themselves journalists has grown. But there are other cuts as well. This strive or this race toward efficiencies has caused other cuts to save costs in the newsroom. Investigative reporting has suffered. Investigative reporting is something that takes a tremendous amount of investment, and that investment is not being made because it's not cost effective. Localism has suffered. You know, in journalism, and particularly in the area of journalism that I'm most familiar with, which is print journalism, daily newspapers, it's all about location, location, location. You have to be in the locale. You have to know what's happening in the community. You have to be connected to that community. And as a result of all these trends, it's created kind of a bubble around reporters in the mainstream media. There is a real elitism that has grown up and around the whole newsroom culture of today. I think that readers, audiences sense that, and I think that that also explains a lot of the turnoff and distrust in the media. The reporters that I represent, oftentimes their stories don't represent what's happening to real people, and I think real people know that. Their employer's reaction to that, the reporter's employer's reaction to that, has been, among other things, to restrict further interaction between those mainstream reporters in their community by erecting more barriers. For example, saying that reporters can't be involved in their communities and trying to impose codes of conduct that actually are portrayed as ethics codes, but they're more about conflicts of interest, which need to be monitored. Reporters need to be mindful of not writing self-serving stories. But I think that we've gone overboard to the point where reporters are actually isolated from real people. So there are fewer reporters, fewer resources devoted to news gathering. And then what that's resulted in, on a very personal level for those reporters, is there's less passion about journalism for those who are left. You know, this used to be fun. It used to be a fun profession to be in. It's not so anymore in the mainstream media. That, too, adds to the loss of credibility with the public who, you know, senses that. I mean, if there's less passion for covering the news, then the news is going to be covered in a more superficial way. I think there are several trends that we need to try and reverse, and these are tall orders because I don't know that you can reverse these trends, but there are several, I'll say, trends that we need to fight. One is the commoditization of news. This is in addition to the overall media reform movement that has, as was described last night, been fairly effective recently at turning back the move to further deregulate media ownership. But in addition to that, I think that we need to fight other things that are happening. One is the commoditization of news. For most of these conglomerates, news in particular, is a very minor part of their business. I mean, even the pure media companies, like, for example, Tribune Company or Gannett or any number of other media companies that we think of in terms of, you know, these folks are in the news business. News itself is becoming a smaller and smaller portion of the business that they are in. And then when you look at a lot of the other big players like ABC, Disney, and GE, NBC, Universal, or Viacom, not only news but media is a very, very small piece of an even larger conglomerate and amalgamated business plan that they have. And that makes it increasingly difficult to get an investment in news. So some of the stuff that Orville was talking about in terms of the ownership and how news and information is a part of business and how it's funded, how it's run as a business is really, really important to this whole struggle. Just as an illustration, we did a survey last year among our members along with AFTRA, the American Federation of Television and Radio Artists, the Writers Guild of America East, and the National Association of Broadcast Employees and Technicians, unions that all represent journalists. And we did a survey among our members and asked them, what do you think is the biggest problem with newsrooms today in terms of, you know, working in the newsrooms and getting your work done? And they said that it was the corporate influence, that ahead of anything else, ahead of job cuts and everything else, was really what hindered them the most in doing their jobs. Another, I think, thing that needs to be worked on here is the wall between news. We need to tear down the wall between news professionals and their communities. News organizations need to hire fewer business reporters and more labor reporters or workplace reporters. They need to hire fewer financial reporters and more farm reporters or rural reporters, rural community reporters. They need to connect back to the communities that they cover. And journalists need a voice at work. That's why I'm with the Newspaper Guild. I started off as a journalist, not as a trade unionist. And I came to the Newspaper Guild because I feel very strongly that journalists need a voice at work. They need to be able to fight for stories. And they need to be able to push to get things covered without the fear of being retaliated against by their corporate bosses. News organizations also need to infuse diversity in their operations. That means diversity of all kinds, diversity of viewpoint, diversity of coverage, as in communities that we cover, and diversity in ownership of outlets. And, you know, you could get into a whole discussion about bloggers and how the whole blogosphere has risen as a news source. And I think that has to do with diversity and the fact that mainstream news organizations do not provide enough diversity of viewpoint and of coverage of different voices in what they do. And then finally, news organizations need to make restoration of credibility the top priority, not just in the newsrooms, but in the boardrooms. That means that a code of ethics in the newsroom to prevent plagiarism is a good thing, but there also needs to be a code of ethics for the boardroom, there needs to be a code of ethics in the circulation department, there needs to be a code of ethics in the advertising department. These industries have to be clean, they have to be credible, and they have to speak to what people think are good values. And then finally, this notion, and we heard a little bit about this last night, of targeting journalists, both physically in places like Iraq, where a record number of journalists have been killed, 63, I think, was the last count, or even in this country where there's always, no matter what the story is, if the story is about George W. Bush not serving in the National Guard or missing out on his Guard service during Vietnam, and then it turns around, they blame the media, and all of a sudden blaming the media and blaming Dan Rather and finding and looking for mistakes that Dan Rather made becomes the story. So the journalist, instead of George W. Bush's service, becomes the target. There is a blame the media, meaning blame the reporters, feeling in this country that we need to change. You can't keep targeting reporters and news people and expect them to do their jobs in a way that that is conducive to public discourse. And then finally, I'd just like to put in a plug for an effort that we're undertaking in the Guild, in that we are going to come up with, or we're in the process of developing, our own code of ethics for this industry. One that, yes, deals somewhat with conflict of interest, but really is set, we want to set out a way to promote credibility, to restore credibility back in this industry, to really talk about ethical practices that need to be imbued in this industry. And hopefully, if we can do that from the bottom up, we'll get some buy-in from the top down. No guarantees on that, but I think there needs to be pressure on those folks at the top to really, really be as ethical as they're supposed to be in running a business as important as this. And then finally, I just wanted to end with a quote from James Madison, because I think oftentimes, particularly in the media reform movement, of which I consider myself very much a part of, we sometimes get kind of depressed and we get very negative about the press. But I always go back to this quote from James Madison because I think it's important to keep this in mind. And he said, "To the press alone, checkered as it is with abuses, the world is indebted for all the triumphs which have been gained by reason and humanity over error and repression." And I think our goal has to make sure that when it comes to the media, that humanity triumphs over repression. Thank you.
Thanks, Linda. Thank you very much. Next speaker, Danny.
I'm kind of an anomaly up here among these eminent writers. I come from the rock and roll business, and for the last few months I've been running AM talk radio network. So I see the world through a more tabloid lens. I also may be an anomaly because as horrifying as it is that the government's been complicit in torture, and as daunting as it is, the media concentration, I do have still my rock and roll optimism. And I think it's complicated when you look at these big media companies, because you still have Fox, which produces the worst and most reactionary news in history, also putting out The Simpsons every week, which is probably the best entertainment show with a political subtext that's ever been created. My kids watch all these Fox cartoons. There's a new one called American Dad that had in it a mock headline this week that said, "Optimist drowns in half-full tub." So, although I'm an optimist, I'm well aware that the water is rising and that we have to sit up a little bit straighter. But I was really taken with Amy Goodman last night when she talked about the awful complicity of the New York Times after Hiroshima and Nagasaki in putting a sugar coating on the nuclear bomb. And I think it's part of being an optimist to me is not to romanticize the past. That the era of William Randolph Hearst and Colonel Patterson and some of these people didn't create the greatest media in the world. Vietnam did happen despite the valiant efforts of people like Seymour Hersh, and a lot of people died needlessly, and this country was hurt needlessly because people like the New York Times were not early enough in questioning things. So I don't think the past was that great, and therefore I don't think things are quite as horrible by comparison today as sometimes is said, but they're bad enough. I also think that when you talk about media concentration, alternative media, it is important to look at it through a somewhat wider lens. I noticed by the people that are here, we're all to the left, I certainly am, but there were a lot of people to the right that hated the New Deal, that hated Eisenhower getting the nomination instead of Taft, who felt equally alienated from the media. And there are two books about this that are really worth reading to understand how alternative media and an outsider political group can reach the public, because if we're going to change all these laws and change all the ownership of media, we're going to have to change the government. And we can't do that without convincing a lot more people, because as we know from 2000, if the election's a tie, we lose. So we have to decisively and overwhelmingly change the attitudes of the public. And one of them is Thunder on the Right by Rick Perlstein, which is about the Barry Goldwater campaign and the forces that led up to it. And the other is by one of the architects of today's conservative establishment, Richard Viguerie, called America's Right Turn. And he focuses on the role of talk radio, direct mail, which he's the big maven on, and other type of alternative media by which they were able to create an ever-growing force politically. And I think that what's happening since 9/11 is the beginning of that on the left. I think that it's a big deal that Michael Moore's movie did $130 million. I think it's a big deal that Move On has emerged and been able to do what they do. And I hope it's a big deal. I think it's a very big deal that Amy Goodman's been able to create what she did at a point when she was almost pushed out of Pacifica and to come back. And I'm not sure whether it's going to be our company or not, but there is something happening in commercial talk radio that's pretty exciting. I don't know if any of you saw the HBO special about Air America, but it reminds me of the movie Woodstock. I'm old enough to have been at Woodstock. I reviewed it for Billboard magazine when I was 19, and it was amazing to see this unbelievable force, and at the center of it were four guys who had absolutely no idea what they had done right. The promoters of the concert, it was a dope dealer and somebody with rich parents that put up a little bit of money and other people. They never did anything again of any significance in the music business, but they had one great idea. And that's kind of what happened with the scam artists and incompetents that started Air America, who have all left. But they had one great idea, which was that there was an underserved audience, that it wasn't only people who watch PBS and read The Nation, who wanted to hear an alternative to conservative news. And despite underfunding and competence and so on, the three stations that were surviving broadcasting, Al Franken and Janine Garofalo and Randy Rhodes and some of the others last spring, got ratings that are good enough that today we're on 56 radio stations, reaching 60% of the United States, 17 of the top 20 markets. And it's just since January we've picked up Los Angeles, Dallas, Columbia, South Carolina, Chicago. It's certainly nothing I've done. I just got there a couple of months ago. It's the desire on the part of a public who's not usually considered part of the liberal elite, but who are unsettled and disturbed and upset by the sameness and rigid orthodoxy of what they're getting from cable news and from conservative talk radio. And whether it's us, and I think it will be, or other people, we're up to about 4 million people a week that listen to our shows between the internet and the terrestrial broadcasting. It's going to be 5 by the end of the year, and there's competition being spawned. And it's, again, the paradox of centralized ownership is, you know, Michael Moore is a big believer in using the beast to fight the beast, and that's why he's done work with Fox, put out one of his books, and Disney funded Fahrenheit, and now Warner Books put out one of his books. And it's similarly, of our 56 stations, 23 of them are owned by Clear Channel. And it's not that we have any naivete about what their goal is. Their goal is to make money. And the fact is that, for the moment, the greed and the amorality of seeking profits, and which are driven by ratings, trumps any particular political feelings they may have. And that has been a common thing in the media. To me, a lot of the media, as important as distribution and ownership is, I think creativity of visionary people is in some ways more important. Last time I remember, the New Yorker did an editorial supporting the war in Iraq. They've got this doofus, Jeffrey Goldberg, who said that, without any irony, that Bush is going to be like Lincoln in his article about Douglas Fipe. But they did create a platform for you to do your incredibly important work, Mr. Hirsch. So I think that there is the ability of artists, of visionary journalists, and of creative, content-driven people to somehow navigate through this, and that it's important as we talk about ownership to also talk about supporting that kind of creativity, because ultimately that's what drives these big companies. I saw in the record business, believe me, hip-hop had a lot more influence on the record business than the record business did on hip-hop. And I think that's the opportunity if you can find enough geniuses and support them. So I don't know exactly how this fits into the rest of the conversation, but it's a great honor to be here, and I thank you for listening.
Thank you, sir.
One more thing about being optimistic. The bad guys want us to be pessimistic. Fuck them.
All right. On that note, Cy?
My rock and roll pal here has got a point that we should emphasize. The book I just did on Abu Ghraib was published by HarperCollins, which is owned by Murdoch, and it is bottom line. And I have this fantasy with these bottom line companies. As Linda was saying, I think eventually what might happen is maybe, you know, the Tribune, or certainly maybe the New York Times Company eventually will spin off its news division. That might be a good idea. You know, it's becoming significantly less and less important to them as they go along, as they do all this other stuff. But what Orville was talking about and what my rock and roll reminded me we do need something different. I don't know how we're going to get to it. And Orville, you didn't have much of an answer either, because we need, you know, whether it's going to be somebody's going to set up a trust fund in Nevada, maybe. But I remember in the heyday of the good times, this is how we always do wine in our profession. We are professional winers, sort of like in the Army. We always wine. In the heyday in 74 or 5, I'd done My Lai, and Wilbur and Bernstein had done Watergate, and then the New York Times had been terribly, really negligent on Watergate because Henry Kissinger used to assure us. Henry Kissinger, who, by the way, lies like most people breathe, had assured the New York Times. He kept on telling, well, yeah, but you know something? I wish we had a Kissinger now running the government, because at least we know somewhere somebody has some scheme up there, some thought, instead of this mad ideology that runs, pervades our government, which is going to lead us who knows where. At least Kissinger, it was always for the oil or for the Israelis or some gam, or maybe even a private company had on the side, but we don't have that now. Anyway, but in any case, so by 74 and 7, I was assigned by Abe Rosenthal to be the catch-up guy in Watergate. So in 73 and 74, I began to cook on the cover-up, and Woodward and I and Bernstein and I became friends. And one day in late 74, we had a night with Jan Wenner. Now, this time was it's still functioning, but then in 74, 75, 76, Rolling Stone really was a profound social a commentator and a great influence on the young kids. It was the John Stewart of its generation. And so we did this night of, I guess you could call it extreme partying, sort of like extreme skiing with him. And Woodward, absolutely, I must tell you, abstained. At the high point of all this, we got this great idea. What if Hirsch, Woodward, and Bernstein got together? This is 74, 75, and we'd all been hot on Watergate, and I'd done the stuff in Vietnam. What if we set up a public company, sold public shares, and announced a publicly financed investigation into the assassination of John F. Kennedy, which was the big issue in 73, 74, 75, sort of. It still lingers, but it was huge 30 years ago. You know, who really killed John F. Kennedy, and was Oswald alone? Nobody believed the Warren Commission. There's still these doubts, but, you know, time has pushed it in the background. Time and other horrible events. And so the idea was, by the time we all stopped freaking out, we were convinced it was good for $40 or $50 million in public. We were going to sell it for $10 or $20 a share. The public could join in. We were going to set up a trust. Everybody was going to buy stock. The Rolling Stone would publish it. But the public would underwrite an independent investigation. And we knew it would be enormous, you know, because the names we all had then, it would just be huge. In the morning, I woke up and said, no way. And I don't know what the other guys did, but I said, no way. And I wasn't going to do it. I went back to my little tedious life at the New York Times. And the point being that we haven't begun to explore the other options for alternative media. And also that what we have isn't totally moribund yet. I mean, the New York Times will run a great story if you give them a great story and you can get it by. My general problem has been in 40 years being a newspaper person, I've watched the kind of people in newspapers and magazines that come, move up through the ranks and become editors. I won't say this about deans. And generally, the general attitude I have is most editors as somebody said about me, I do believe it's true, most editors are mice training to be rats. And so that's one of the generic problems we have. That's probably just as important as corporate ownership in a way. And so you have a bunch of toadies that get promoted because that's what people like to promote, particularly in corporations. Well, yeah, unfortunately, and here we are. It's not only trade unions that don't get reported anymore. That's sort of a blasé story. Nobody reports the underclass. Nobody reports on poor people, really. Every once in a while, you'll have a token story. But we have, you know, incredible problems of the gap between rich and poor. And I think what talk radio shows, I think what the Democrats have always done wrong politically is they're always telling everybody you're a victim. You can't win votes by telling people you're being victimized. And so talk radio gives people a way to get off. They can articulate what they feel and think in a way that doesn't make them victims. I'm telling you, the next person that runs for president that can figure out a way to stop calling the downtrodden victims is going to win. Nobody likes to be called a patsy. And that's all Democrats do. You're victimized by the rich and the Yes, they are, but that isn't the way to win their vote. I don't have an answer for the other side. Because it involves a certain kind of genius. I don't know who is going to hit somebody, but it doesn't involve political operators. They don't see it. Got to find a way to talk to them. And talk radio in its funny little inchoate, to use the word that Orville used, way, does articulate something. If you can find a way to get people to talk about what they're talking about in a non-judgmental, non-victim sense, you can really turn people around in this country. Admittedly, it's real easy pointing out the problem, how to do it. But I'll tell you, the next guy that wants to be president in this country better start talking about this war, and quickly, and he'll be president. I'll tell you that. I worked for Gene McCarthy in 67. I joined him at the worst time. And no matter how bad it was in New Hampshire, we knew if he, and he did it to his credit. Difficult, I was talking about him earlier. That's what makes me bring it up. He stuck to the guns. He did what Bobby wouldn't do. He went out there and campaigned and took on the war. And he could have, you know, because of personality and other issues, you know, he could have gone much farther than he did. But it's there for the taking. Kerry wouldn't do it. That's why we didn't lose the election. Bush didn't win the election. We lost it, the Democrats, because he ran the wrong guy, wrong time, wrong place. Anyway, there we are.
Thank you very much, sir. We're ready to take some questions from the floor. If anybody has a question or a comment or a complaint. All right. Start over here.
It's primarily for Mr. Hirsch, and kind of following up on some of the things he said last night, but for the other panelists as well. I was wondering what it says about our media that the story of Abu Ghraib didn't become big news until there were pictures, when our Christian Peacemaker team in Baghdad had been reporting on the abuses, not only in Abu Ghraib, but other detention facilities in Iraq for at least 6 months before that.
Well, jingoism, just to make it quickly, Americans are very patriotic jingoism. We don't like to think our boys do that stuff. You know, in My Lai, it took a year and a half for that story to get out. So there's nothing extraordinary about the fact that Human Rights Watch, not only your other, I've talked to many people who, the Mennonites, others who knew firsthand about horrible events, dog-on-man stuff events. And so basically, that's not really so surprising that it took photographs. And that's what makes when you start thinking about that, you start to realize about the almost catastrophic failure of the major television networks to cover the war. Because it's those events that can be seen that can really trigger. There's nothing quite as powerful as an image. You know, it's obvious cliche. And all it does is suggest how badly we've done. But I'm not surprised that it took an image. You know,
if any of you others, folks, would like to jump in on some of these questions, feel free to do so. I'll shift to this side of the room.
I agree with Ms. Foley for all my life, that humanity has won over oppression. But in our present times, it seems humanity is losing, and it's scary. Some days I feel like I'm living in a brave new world. I was appalled a couple of weeks ago to read a piece in the Chicago Tribune that was picked up from the New York Times that our government has plans for us via NPR and PBS. It had already become apparent to me several months ago. But this was even more distressing because the woman who was in charge of PBS had been removed, and a more right-wing Wilhelmsen character is going to replace her. I feel like those two media outlets are in part owned by us because we are taxpayers and our money goes to fund those. So what can we do? And in a really distressing segment on the Lara show about 3 months ago was a so-called discussion about global warming. And the advocates of, yes, there is global warming, were represented by a woman who was poorly spoken, unknown name, stumbling all over the place, versus a young man who was just right on, like a tank. No one of the like of Steve Snyder or anyone of that caliber represented that group.
Thank you very much. Do you want to jump in there?
So what can we do about these things?
One thing I find very troublesome is the way in which public relations techniques, which interestingly enough were sort of pioneered by a nephew of Sigmund Freud, Edward Bernays, and which really sort of plumbed the psyche of human beings the better to market to us. But the ways in which these techniques have now, in a very unholy way, formed some new sort of biogenetic alliance with politics. And I do think that this is something that is very difficult to sort of analyze and take apart, but it is something that we see on television in myriad forms. And it enables, for instance, a proponent or an opponent of the notion of global warming to come across and seem flawless and very, very convincing and very slick and well-prepared, whereas somebody who may actually have know the chapter and verse of the reality of the science of global warming seems to stumble and be unconvincing. And I think this is a real problem. We call it spin. And we live in a world where everything gets spun, from our politicians to our products to our news. And, you know, I know that in many universities, I think at this one, perhaps even in your department, advertising, public relations is in the same department as journalism. Well, this is something we really ought to talk about. Do they belong together? In my view, there ought to be a bit of a firewall because these are very different enterprises, and I think they've joined in, particularly in broadcast, in a way that makes it very difficult for people to see through to the reality of what's really happening through the presentation.
Well, you know, just to jump in there
very
quickly.
No,
you're not attacking. I want to clarify, however, that the College of Communications has three departments, Advertising, Journalism, and Media Studies, ICR, Institute for Communications Research, and they are, at least between Advertising and Journalism, there is what we would call a pretty heavy Chinese wall between the two units, and you don't have a lot of overlap. In fact, you have none, and that's really due to the fact that a lot of the journalism faculty would not tolerate that. So it's there is that system within our college. However, you're right. I do believe in a lot of other programs around the country. They are together. And if I could just add one thing to your answer your question very quickly, because the PBS affiliate here, WIL television, and of course WIL radio which is the NPR affiliate, are both part of the college. And what you said is hits a raw nerve with us because, you know, we are getting less and less funding from the government for all of our programming. And if you've been watching and listening over the last couple of weeks, you know we've been in a fund drive trying to raise money for our station. And the only way we're going to be able to save what we do and to provide the kind of quality programming that we've been able to provide in the past is through the support of people like you. Unfortunately, we're not getting it from the government. And there is a movement afoot to disband the whole concept of PBS and NPR, which is a rather distressing movement. I'm sorry, I didn't want to take
your
time. No,
that's okay. I just wanted to follow up on that point also. Orville talked about some other models of public service broadcasting, and you have to be careful because we are talking about public service broadcasting, not broadcasting that's controlled by the government, as opposed to supported by the government and supported by the people. You know, there are other models out there, as he pointed out. You know, you need just look to the north at the CBC, which is one of the best, I think, news organizations in North America, if not in the world.
But in trouble.
In great trouble. Actually, we represent the workers there as well, and, you know, they're facing layoffs. There's a lot of pressure to downsize the CBC and to change the funding structure, and it's always a huge struggle there. And also he mentioned the BBC, which is also in trouble. But there are other models out there, and there are opportunities even in this country to change the public service broadcasting model that we have. You know, there is a difference between going out and soliciting funds and actually having subscribers or citizen subscribers support media. International World Television is an idea that Paul Jay has. He's here, and I think he's going to be speaking about this later. That's an interesting concept where subscribers or citizens actually support through a subscription fee or some sort of payment on a regular basis a news organization. The satellite radio is a model of that. And there are other opportunities. There's the digital spectrum opens up a lot of possibilities in this area. And the government could get involved, if we had a government that was so inclined, to take some of those profits that will be made, for example, from use of the digital spectrum and put them toward public service broadcasting. We have to make this a top priority along with everything else, because if we don't, you're absolutely right, we will lose any semblance of public service broadcasting in this country.
Go back
very
to another
shortly.
Question over here.
Can I just comment?
Sure.
The McNeil era has been terrible for years. It's really, if you look at the studies of fairness and accuracy in media and the proportion of conservatives and Republicans they have and how rare they have real progressives on, you read Eric Alterman's book, What Liberal Media, it's really important to stop pretending that these flaccid organisms that got intimidated 15 years ago by the right wing are still, for the most part, a vehicle for progressives. There are some geniuses with enough of a resume and bona fides that they're able to get into the New York Times and into other major media. But on global warming, for example, Elizabeth Colbert wrote this incredible three-part piece in the New Yorker recently. I'm happy to say she was on Al Franken's show. And the key for progressives is to support progressive media and not to kid ourselves about the likelihood of the government bailing us out anytime soon. We need progressive media to change the government, and then maybe we can go back to the government for some of these things. And lest we forget, there was $500 million raised from progressives for the last election, and we had the wrong candidate. And, you know, if some of that money that foundations have and that the wealthy donors of this world have and that the grassroots through Move On have start supporting progressive media to one-tenth that amount, we're going to have a very interesting political conversation in this country without any help from McNeil era.
One more thing about media in this community. Unless you have cable television, which I do not, the only progressive outlets are WEFT radio, and PBS comes closest, WILL, than anybody else. Our Channel 15 and NBC outlet is a Sinclair-owned group.
Now, go ahead.
I'd like to ask Mr. Goldberg about the progressive credentials of Air America, which were attacked last week in a piece on the website counterpunch.org. You drew a parallel with Move On. Move On apparently opposes withdrawal from Iraq, and apparently also so does Air America.
Air America doesn't tell the people who are on the air what to say. We have a diversity of things. Certainly, Janine Garofalo wants withdrawal from Iraq. I'd like withdrawal from Iraq. You know, we have, I think Laura Flanders certainly does. There's a dozen different people on the air, and we don't give them party line insistence. But I would just suggest airamericaradio.com, or you can listen, and airamericaplace.com has all the shows archived, and check them out, and you decide yourself what you think of its politics and whether it's contributing something to the dialogue in the country.
Over here.
Yeah. I don't know the relative importance insofar as public opinion is concerned between newspapers like the New York Times and the news services. But what strikes me, I look at AP, I look at Reuters, I look at Agence France-Presse, and what is particularly striking is that they all tell the same stories in almost the same way all the time. And I'd like you to explicate a little bit on why that uniformity exists, for example, on those particular press services, which I feel are extremely important in dispersing the news. I have one other comment, but I'd like to. Let me get to the second thing. I read Le Monde Diplomatique, which is a monthly periodical from France. Now, they have a rather progressive editorial board, and it's supported by a group which is called the Friends of Le Monde Diplomatique. And they, in fact, have essentially a stock ownership in that paper. And that's another mode which could be explored by the progressive community here if there were, you know, an outlet to have some newspaper like that. So maybe people can answer those two different things.
Thank you. Sai, do you want to jump on the first one?
Well, having worked for AP, I sort of am aghast that you might have different expectations. I mean, not that they don't do a competent job, but it's not where you're not going to end the world there. I mean, it's just not what you do. You go there and you work there and you learn things, and there's a lot of things to learn. You know, this is a profession. This is a trade. It's more than a trade. And we're you learn you can have an opinion and still write objectively or honestly about people. I ended up hating the Vietnam War, and I began to view Robert McNamara when I covered the Pentagon for the AP in the 60s as a psychotic liar, a view I haven't changed. He doesn't know when he's lying. But I was able to cover his news conferences very straightforwardly. Maybe the next day I'd write a piece for the AP being critical, but that day I could do it. But I don't know quite. No, AFP sometimes does better stuff, but particularly from Africa. But what expectation do you have? I don't quite understand what your point is. You really expect them to, you know, they're, you know, duh.
No, my point is you have three news services. Why are they all exactly the same?
Why is every newspaper the same so often?
They aren't. They haven't been always the same.
If you look at the coverage of Iraq, basically, if you know, you get a briefing, you get a press conference, I think an awful lot of the coverage is the same. The AP and the wire services still don't have a lot of money to explore and doing, you know, investigative pieces. That's not something they invest in very much. They're busy covering the news. So, and I think they do a plenty adequate job. They sound the same because we all sound the same. I mean, where do you think we are? Why do you think we are and what we are in? This is, you know, we've got a war that's completely mad. It's disassociative. There's a response to 9/11 was to go to Iraq. Osama bin Laden in 1991, after Saddam goes into Kuwait, goes from Afghanistan home to Saudi Arabia and says, let me go take my mujahideen and fight the infidel in Baghdad. That's his attitude towards Saddam. He hated Saddam, and part of the trouble he has, he writes about this in his various fatwas, is that, you know, and we have the same. I don't understand. I'm not making you happy, but I don't understand what you want from a wire service.
You know, one thing, so I would say that perhaps why there is a similarity. You know, it used to be that these services came out of a country. You know, Reuters, British, Agence France-Presse was French. But in actuality, America really rules in this sort of global news dissemination. And I think what we really need is some sort of a news service that doesn't belong to any country in this globalized world. And we sort of haven't broken the gravity of the grip of a certain kind of an operation that very often is very Western-centric and American-centric. As to your second question, let me just raise another very interesting model for the way a media outlet is held. Sai and I were talking about this, but Der Spiegel in Germany is owned by its employees. It's very successful and makes a lot of money, but every correspondent holds stock in the company. It's a kind of an interesting model, and I don't think there's anything quite like it in this country.
There used to be. It was called profit sharing. Kind of stopped doing that. Over here.
Yes. I had a question as far as what do you think the continuing role of television and radio and newspapers will be now that so many people get their news through the internet, and I don't know that many people my age who actually have a subscription to a newspaper because you can just go online and get it for free, or that you can download a radio program onto an iPod and listen to that. And how much are these traditional medias becoming obsolete, and what is their role in the future?
I think their role has to be more based on creativity and the personality of writers. I feel the same way. I get the newspaper sometimes, and I think, gee, I already must have read this before, because this morning I'd already gotten it on the internet or seen it on TV. So they become more journals of analysis and opinion. It becomes more like Britain, and I think that's fine. I think there's always been advocacy in journalism. It was just masqueraded by the pretension of objectivity. It was representing a very narrow spectrum and whatever the center elite was at the time, and I think more open ideological arguments between the media creates a better awareness in the public than this illusion of three networks who are telling you the truth when in fact they were only telling you 10% of the truth. But it's clearly the news delivering function of newspapers is withering away, and it's got to be more and more the talent of writers on how they analyze and discuss it.
I think that it's definitely right that newspapers, that print media in general is declining while the use of the internet for news and information is rising. However, that can be overstated. There have been a number of recent polls, and there's just a study that came out by the Knight Foundation, as a matter of fact, among younger people that actually says, we still shouldn't forget that the vast majority of people in this country, whether they use the internet or not, get their news from television. And television still is the primary medium by which people get their news. So while it is true that it does, I think it is going to have to fundamentally change print media, not just in what it delivers, but also I think its business model. With broadcast and particularly with television, television still is by far and away the most dominant media in terms of where people get their news.
We go back over to this side.
Yeah, I have a related question, and that's sort of, do you see sort of liberating potential with the internet? Does it have a potential to do something that mainstream media doesn't? Like, I love reading The Guardian, and I can only read it because I have internet connection. Or is this sort of, do you think this sort of rising blogosphere by sort of getting rid of any notion of verifiability just makes things worse? That it's just, you see it as a range of opinions, and there's nothing to sort of hang your hat on.
I think it makes things better. I think there's places, there's websites, there's institutions that are known for facts, but more opinions is better. The problem has been there's been too narrow a discussion. It was stultified, and that's part of why we've had this whole aberration of not talking about the things that Bernie Sanders was talking about last night. And I think that it also increases the voice of Nazis and all sorts of awful people. But to me, more speech is better. And it's a moment where it's harder and harder for an elite in power to control the conversation in the society, and therefore, and that's better.
Yeah, I think it definitely makes things better for the reasons that Danny stated, but I also think that it provides kind of a unique opportunity for journalists to do what journalists have kind of always done in a different way. I mean, journalists have always been it's always been a profession where you look at the world around you and you filter that and you channel that so that people who don't have access to that information can learn something from, you know, what you write or what you produce on the air. And I think with the blogosphere that there is a real role for journalists there to filter and to channel to information that's credible and that's correct and to help people sort out what's true and what isn't true, what's credible and what isn't credible. If journalists are smart and if news organizations are smart about using the blogosphere in that way.
One just quick thought. It may come to pass that citizens' journalism, where people all around the world are feeding in good stories to internet outlets. However, we don't have that happening yet. And nobody quite understands how the internet is going to keep bureaus open around the world to be reporting in a way that is credible. So at this point, not only is there not that reach for the internet, but also, again, to get back to business models, nobody's got a business model to make money on the internet. And until they do, they're not going to be able to support much real reporting, and they're going to be limited to the role of critic, which is a very important one.
Over here.
Yes, I just want to ask Mr. Hirsch a question. I want to thank you very much, all of you, actually, but Mr. Hirsch, just several months ago, you wrote about Iran and special forces that are slipping in behind the borders. And just recently, Scott Ritter wrote about the fact that, I mean, he predicted that we would enter or expand the war effort and go into Iran. Of course, there's lots of speculation about that, and apparently we don't have enough soldiers to do that, and we know there's a large army in Iran, but I wonder what your view on that issue, especially in terms of the neocon intentionality, how you view that scene right now.
Well, nobody knows what's going to happen. I mean, we certainly wouldn't invade on the ground. We'd hit them by air and hit them hard. I mean, that's the planning. I mean, there's, of course, incredible planning going on. People describe it as 20x shock and awe in Baghdad, but that's not surprising. If you bomb a certain amount of potential nuclear sites before you bomb, you have to take out the airfields and the anti-aircraft defenses and the radar installations, and you're looking at 300-400 target lists. So that's just normal, normal if that's the right word, but nobody knows what they're going to do. But, you know, when people helped me do that story on the inside about the Iranian planning, what they said to me, if your story works, is it'll be wrong. In other words, by right. That's what they said. So it was an unusual position to be in. The write a story that if it works, it won't happen. They were trying, obviously, to through me, to let the world know about this intense planning that's going on. It's still going on. I think there's a new reality. Oil is very... The administration's discovered that they have a problem with oil, and Iran has a lot of it. These guys, you know, they do act very instinctively. And so I don't know what's going to happen. If you'd asked me in January 2003, I would have said, no way they're going into Iraq. It's just too crazy. So I say to you here now, no way we're going to go into Iran. I think the real problem we have if we go into Iran is we'd lose. We haven't lost one since Grenada, I guess, or something like that, but we'd lose. We'd lose.
Over here.
I wanted to thank the panel, first of all, for thought-provoking discussion. And also, I don't intend to shift the focus of the discussion, but if you would please consider or address the issue of public apathy in general. Of course, not everyone, but it seems to me that even when the truth or the reality is revealed to the public, sometimes after the fact, unfortunately, still we don't get the reaction that we expect to get from the public. Mr. Hirsch's, you know, articles followed by pictures of Abu Ghraib first created a kind of shock and denial, but then nothing happened. And the same is true with the lies of the administration that was basically revealed in the newspapers, and we still elected the same administration. And wanted to see how you feel about when we're addressing the problems of the press and the journalists, where do the consumers of the news come into? And aren't we as consumers ultimately responsible for what we get from the newspapers and the other media?
Thank you. We'll have to end the question so we can get an answer, because they have to leave in about 3 or 4 minutes. But just to very quickly jump in there, you know, there was an old story about Yogi Berra talking about why he couldn't get anybody to come out to the Mets ball games, you know, and they said, well, if they don't want to come out to the games, you can't stop them, you know. And so I think, in a way, there is a fact about the responsibility of the public. Also, as you say, the apathy of the public, the people who are consumers of what we put out, what the product that we produce, to do what they're supposed to do, and that is to analyze, look at, understand, and respond to the kinds of news that they're getting, and that's what we're happening. That's what's happening right here in this room. But I'll turn it over to the panel here. Go ahead, Linda.
One way to describe apathy is an unspoken sense of powerlessness. And I think that it goes back to what Danny was saying. As long as people are being told by the other side, or by the side that's not in power, I should say, not the other side, by our side, that they're victims, they're going to feel powerless. And so there needs to be, and you know, I don't know what the answer is in terms of the media, but there needs to be a sense that something can be done about problems that real people face. And that's, you know, that's kind of a short answer, but that's really what we have to strive to do in order to activate people more.
I think we need an opposition political party. You know, George Bush George Bush's most popular line was, he said, "You may not always agree with what I do, but you'll know where I stand." That, to me, is why he won. Mm-hmm. Kerry never could say that with a straight face, because it wasn't true. We now have people that want to be president next time who support this empire foreign policy. Somebody has to emerge, and we have to support them to have an alternative. We need a Gene McCarthy. We need, I don't know whether it's Russ Feingold, whether it's somebody else, but if we have Democrats who fundamentally agree with the foreign policy of the Republicans, it's very hard for the public to get too excited about the Democrats.
Anybody else? Do we have time for one more question?
Sure.
Then I'll take one question over there. Okay, go ahead.
Thanks, I appreciate it. This is for Goldberg. You guys are in the position to actually put out this position. I can't turn on TV and hear that we need an opposition party. I can't turn on NPR and hear it. There's no reform group to fix NPR. You guys have the ability to point out media problems elsewhere because you're free. You can do it on your own. By the way, how do I invest in that? Anyway, I'm making the suggestion that, you know, you guys can do this, and you just said you don't control what the broadcasters say. Nonetheless, it's really fertile ground for putting out the ideas that NPR is broken, that the Democratic Party is broken, and I don't hear it when I listen to your station. That's all.
Well, I think some people deal with it. It's 24/7. It's a brand new company. I say it's kind of like living in a house while you're still building the roof. I think we'll get there, and I think some of the people on the air are going to be part of a process. Certainly not limited to us. It includes Amy. It includes The Nation. It includes some of the websites. I think the progressive community in general has to start focusing on this and really holding Democrats' feet to the fire. Somebody's going to want the support of people like us, and we have to really be vocal about it so that we don't get in the situation we were in the last election.
Thank you very much. We have to untether two of our panelists. They've got to get to Willard Airport. So thank you very much for all.